Welcome to the Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast, conversations with leaders who made difficult decisions and built lasting legacies. I am Rick Williams. I speak and write about how leaders can be more successful. My best-selling book, Create the Future, is your essential guidebook for making difficult decisions. This podcast is an opportunity for me and for you to hear how leaders with a wide variety of backgrounds have managed the challenges they faced, made difficult decisions, and had courage when going forward is tough. You will learn important lessons from other leaders. You will find that engaging with our 30-minute conversation will be a great investment of your valuable time. So let's get started. Welcome to the Create the Future podcast. I'm Rick Williams. The Create the Future podcast is a forum for leaders to share their stories about making difficult decisions for their company or for any organization, and in some cases for themselves. My goal is to share these stories about leadership and decision-making so that you will become a better leader for your organization. We have a great guest today with a compelling and interesting story to share with you about decision-making for him and what he went through and his experiences with that, what went right, what went wrong, that sort of thing. So I'm excited to introduce you to Nick Jain. Nick is a CEO in terms of job title, CEO, CFO. He's formerly the CEO of IdeaScale and is in the process of starting a new company today. So Nick, welcome to the Create the Future podcast. Give a little bit of an introduction to yourself and your journey up to this point.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on, firstly. The quick bit about me, grew up in India and Canada, both, been now in the States for about 20, 25 years, something like that. Spent about a decade on Wall Street as a professional investor, investing in kind of both private companies as well as public companies, doing a lot of analysis, learning how companies tick, everything from aluminum companies to healthcare companies and paper coupon companies once upon a time as well. But for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been a professional CEO. So for owners of companies or private equity firms have hired me to come either fix broken companies or scale up companies that could do better. I've run a $100 million revenue trucking company. I run and then two smaller companies, one in software and one in men's shoes. And then right now I'm in the, my business partner and I, about 2 months ago, launched an AI powered CFO company. And it was the entire idea there is everyone would love to hire a $500,000 or $1 million salary CFO. That's really expensive and probably out of the capabilities of many smaller businesses. So we said, hey, can we use AI to give you that that CFO experience that a Fortune 500 company would have, except at, 1% the cost. So we're excited. We launched that about 2 months ago, already have paying clients and are now just scaling up our business.
Okay. I you are compelling me to tell a little personal story. Given your venture here as putting together a CFO organization will have CFO expertise to companies. I sit on the board. I'm not going to name the company. I sit on the board of directors. I do a lot of board of directors work for technology companies. I actually have had a board of directors call earlier this week, and the CEO had a slideshow in which he said the end of the year cash on hand for the company was like $650,000. And then sort of the slide a little bit later on showing a cash flow statement, a cash statement, in which is really clear that the end at the cash available, all cash or cash equivalent available was about $37,000. I mean, those were the two slides he had in the same presentation. So, I don't know what CFO was doing or saying or whatever, but anyway, I mean, I literally just had that experience today. And so I know that's not why we're on the call today to talk about it, but I know you wanted to, but that in truth,
that's the easy part.
It's reality of what actually happens. I mean, those are the kinds of things that that you as a leader of your organization are really dealing with. And if you think that CFOing and financial management is just bookkeeping function, you are dead wrong and you're going to be out of business shortly. So I don't know. That's my bit on this. And maybe you want to say something
So I've got a story. So
to.
one of our paying clients, for obvious reasons, I won't name whom, they showed us financial statements which said they had negative $300,000 of cash in the bank. And so we're not responsible for the accounting. Somebody else does the accounting, and we then help them make the business better. We help them make more money. That's what we're really good at. But we looked at it, and we do a first pass just data quality scan. Does this make sense? And we're like, we're pretty sure you don't have negative $300,000 in the bank, because no bank in their right mind is ever going to let you do that. Somebody screwed up badly here. You need to go fix this. And not so much because we care that the numbers are off. It's like, it's hard to run a business when your numbers are so far off they are nonsensical, right?
Right. Yeah, and I will say again, listening to this, people, that is, we're not talking about financial management today. We're talking about decision making. But I am a big advocate for having financial statements that talk to the leader, not the financial expert, but to the leader about what the heck is really going on in this company. Where are we making money? Where are we losing money? Do we really understand what our costs are and where our income is coming from? It's a whole nother subject, but anyway, I, as a board of director member and board chair, I am a big advocate of not just having numbers as bookkeeping, but having numbers as a tool for communicating really what's going on with the company. Anyway, that's my shtick, but whatever. So, Paul, I know you wanted to come on the podcast to talk about very difficult decisions you had to make. Tell us your story. What happened?
I've had to make a lot of difficult decisions over time, and difficult doesn't mean bad in terms of firing people. It's just changes that are personally difficult. For the past several years, I was CEO of a mid-sized software company, and this company had been around for 12, 13 years. It was established, it was growing, it had millions of dollars of revenue, it had 70 or so employees. And I was stepping into the shoes of a retiring CEO and founder. And so those were big shoes to fill, as you can imagine. You have someone who's built the company from the ground up, that they've been with it for 10 or 12 years, and they're well beloved. Customers love them, the employees love them. And I'm stepping in as an outsider to the industry, number one. Number two, the board has given me a very different mandate. It's to grow this company aggressively and make it profitable. And then, see, obviously, I have a different personality as well, right? It's very hard to step in, particularly into the shoes of someone who is very charismatic and well loved, when your personality, in my case, I'm a numbers guy. I love numbers. That's what I'm passionate about in all things in life. Numbers, math, analysis, you name it. I'm a nice guy, but like my brain definitely is. I forget whether it's left brain or right brain, but I'm definitely the math side of the brain thinker. So coming in, my mandate was to professionalize and scale the business, which meant I was going to make a lot of changes that were different from the old way of doing things, and I had to make them really fast. And this was difficult in two ways. Number one, it meant a lot of people were like not going to like me because, like, hey, it's different than the guy we love, and he's making changes to the company that are scary, and we don't know. We don't trust him. We don't know whether they're going to work. And then secondly, having to do a lot of it myself because I'm stepping into an organization which lacked some of these, call it governance or analytic skills. You were talking about numbers that speak to the leader. I was stepping into an organization where there were no numbers being tracked in the first place. I think that was difficult, both kind of just me personally getting a lot of flack initially and criticism and critique, but also the implementation side, because at least for the first 6 or so months, there was a lot of heavy lifting. The title was CEO, but a lot of my job was in the data and in the weeds and like doing manual work, training people and teaching people. That's hard, especially when no one's giving you credit for it.
Yeah, give a little bit of context to this. Was this a founder run company, the founder CEO, and you're coming in as a so-called professional manager replacing the
Yeah,
founder as a
exactly. So it was
CEO? Give
founder
a little
CEO
context to
within.
where the company was.
Yeah, so the company was around, mid-single digits, millions of dollars of revenue, and it had been founder-led for about 12 years. And the founder was retiring, so then I was stepping in as the CEO to then scale the company and take it to its next stage of success.
And was the company a private equity company or a venture capital company? Who was the owner of the
It
company?
was a bootstrapped, privately owned company. So it was very much like a venture company because it's a, mid-sized company, several million dollars in revenue. But they had the good fortune of doing this entirely bootstrapping themselves rather than taking on venture capital. So
So
they're the good.
again, I'm asking just for context because what you're describing is such a common phenomenon that I just make sure we're all understanding kind of what the context was for this. So was the owner saying, "Gee, I've done what I can do. I want to step back," or the only way this company can really go the next step is somebody other than me as the CEO? Kind of, how was that? Where did that come
Yes.
from?
So there were a couple owners, and then one of the owners had been the CEO and has been the CEO for the entire time. But there were a couple of people that owned the company kind of in jointly. And so the owners or the board, whatever you want to call it, said like, okay, the CEO and founder is retiring, and now we need someone else to step in as CEO. And we have a couple of options. We can either promote from within, or we can hire someone external. If we're whatever we do, we know that in order for the company, it's one set of skills to take a company from 0 to $5 million. It's a very different set of skills to take it from $5 million to $100 million, right? And when you're initially at that very small startup, zero revenue scale, a lot of the job is just hustle and grind, right? You do whatever needs to be done to kind of generate revenues and profits. When you're trying to scale that company up to $100 million in revenue, a lot of it is about systems because the company outgrows the once a company is like five, six, $10 million, it's bigger than any one person. No matter how smart the CEO is, no matter how hard he or she works, the company's bigger than the CEO. So you really need systems and processes to get it up to that next stage, that next zero in its trajectory. And so that's what the owners brought me on to do, saying, look, we need a different type now that the founder's retiring, on good terms, by the way. We now want a different type of leader who's going to use a different style to kind of professionalize and scale the company. And that was my mandate, being like a guy to scale up the company rather than kind of just be, the startup guy.
Okay, so what's happening is you're coming in at I will call it an inflection point for the company. It says, okay, we've gotten to this point with a founder CEO. I mean, you haven't said this, but if it's true, you should elaborate on it. I'm assuming that there is more of a collaborative, titles weren't that important. People are sort of in a relatively low structured environment, very typical of early stage entrepreneurial companies. And you're coming in as the person who's now going to say, okay, if we're going to grow, we have to have structure, we have to have very specific roles and goals, and people have to be doing their job collaboratively, but doing their job. And Paul, as the new leader, CEO, is going to be the one who's going to put all this together, change the culture, and grow the company. Am I sort of summarizing what's going on?
Yes, but with I think a slightly different flavor. The company did have some structure, right? It did have titles and there were hierarchies. There were 70 or so people across 7 countries, so or when I joined, like 4 countries. So you did need some level of hierarchy. You need people who had distinct jobs, right? There were technical, there were engineers, there were salespeople. So there were those roles. I think the biggest change, but it was a collaborative culture, where kind of everyone's voice mattered. And I tried to keep that collaborative culture, but what I tried to say is not everyone's voice matters equally. And I don't mean by that in terms of the CEO's voice matters more, but the person with the right answers' voice matters more. And that could be the junior most analyst. So the big cultural shift I made was it's not, everyone can speak, but you must have analysis and evidence behind your perspective. So it doesn't matter if you're this, I was the CEO of the company, I shouldn't just be whiffing off the top of my head. If I'm proposing a plan, it needed to have evidence and data behind it. And if my plan was bad relative to the junior most person, then we're going with the junior most plan person's idea or plan. And that was a big shift when you couldn't just talk, you actually had to have thought about it and done analysis. And that's a cultural shift, right? When you actually have to have done your homework before you show up to a meeting. And it doesn't matter if you're a senior person, if your idea is stupid, it dies. And that's a shift to kind of how organizations run and how egos run, because people are used to just saying, "Hey, I'm the boss. We're going to do what I say." And shifting to, "No, we're going to do the right thing." And the right thing is sometimes not what you want to do. That's a shift.
Right.
It's an
Okay.
uncomfortable shift.
I mean, just again, for your background, so you know who's listening to what you're saying, I was on the board of directors of a company in a very similar situation and was asked to become chairman of the board at a time when the CEO was saying exactly what your previous CEO was saying. I've been in the situation of being asked to be the chairman of the board of directors at the time of a transition like the one you're talking about, and sort of seeing how hard it is for all the reasons you're talking about. I mean, and bringing in a new CEO. So when you came on board, what were the important quote decisions you had to make? Talk about what were the decisions you had to make, and you're making them in a way on behalf of the board, I assume. Part of the question is what was the board's role in all this? But what were the quote decisions you had to make, and then how did you do that? How did you go through making that?
Sure. I think that there were three sets of decisions that I pushed for, or pushed for slash instituted. The board was passive in a good way. They were like, "We've endowed the CEO with, we've endowed Nick, the new CEO, with power. We're going to let him like go run his game plan." So I think there were three sets of decisions. One is we're going to collect a lot more data on everything going on. What's happening to our technology and our bugs? What is happening to how many sales calls are our salespeople making? How much traffic is coming to our website? So we're going to collect a lot more data. Number two is we're going to make lots of small decisions that are we should think of as scientific experiments. It's okay if the decision like comes out negative. It's because we didn't bet the farm. We bet $1,000 instead of $1 million. And number three is emphasizing a product quality. I think we had been a sales-led culture historically that if the customer says jump, we say how high. And I switched it to we need to have a fundamentally good product to sell. And an example of that was within the first month of me joining, there was a customer who was paying us, I forget, like $50,000, $60,000. No, it was $100 and something thousand. That I fired the customer. I said, "Here's your money back. I think you want us to be a custom dev software company rather than a software company. And we are not custom developers. So here's your money back. We apologize that we took it in the first place, but we're not right for you." So it was kind of those three changes: emphasizing collecting the data, number two, measuring things, and number three, making sure that we became a product-led company rather than a sales-led company.
Okay. And you, so you are the hired hand CEO. What was the role of the board in setting this direction, getting clarity with you about what you were going to do? Talk a little bit about that relationship.
So during the hiring process, I asked for all the numbers and where the companies stood, and I did a lot of research both outside and inside out on the company. I laid out like a 30-odd page business plan saying, "Here's the things that I want to change and the things that I want to emphasize." I think I wanted to emphasize if I remember back, this is like 4 or 5 years ago, but my business plan was emphasize the product, number two, improve the customer experience, and number three, add rational decision making, or sorry, evidence-based decision making to each step of the company's process at every level, not just at the CEO level, but every level onwards. And the board liked the plan. I guess that's why they hired me. And then they took, again, a very passive role once I was brought on. And I don't mean passive in a negative way. It was we chat once a month, do kind of almost like a private equity cadence where you chat once a month, talk about the numbers. And if everything's going well, I don't see the board again for another month or several months in some cases. So it was passive in a way that, in a good, I don't want to use that word negatively in the sense that they were out of loop, but rather they gave me all the leash I needed to go execute. And as long as the execution was proceeding well, they were quite happy. The only times when they got actively involved were when I was considering big M&A opportunities because we had started a roll-up of our industry. And there it's a capital decision where I'm saying, like, look, I'm going to, may need to give out 20% of the shares of this company or have new board members, or hey, I'm going to use every, 90% of the bank in our bank account to go do this. This is a strategic enough decision where, we need a second pair of eyes, and not a second pair of eyes to check the math, but we want to make sure this is this the bet we want to take because it changes our capital structure.
Okay. All right. So you show up on day one. I'm thinking day one, week one. What did you do? You say, "Hey, I'm the new CEO." Then what? What did you do to I don't know, to become the leader of the staff? What did you do? And you had a vision of where you wanted to go and how what changes you thought were needed. How did you do that? What did you do to become the leader?
Sure. And to be clear, I don't think I did this, as well as I could have in retrospect.
There's not, believe
So
me, there's no right or wrong in this. It's just if you
I
said,
think I
"Hey,
could have
I
done
went in and
better,
I started telling people what to do, and then I quickly learned that was a big mistake." That's fine. I mean, just it's not, there's no right or wrong in any of this. It's just sharing the experience of what you learned and what what didn't work is learning what didn't work is also a big value in this if you want to talk about it.
Yeah, so I think that the things that I did well were I had the existing CEO and founder and the board members introduce me, right? So it wasn't that I just showed up and sent everyone an email saying, "Hey, I'm now the boss." I was introduced by kind of the departing leaders in a positive way, and the departing leaders stayed on for a transitionary period, and it was a very collaborative relationship. I think those things went well, and I think I also spent a good like week or two trying to meet like ha probably a quarter of the staff personally. And then in over the ensuing months, I literally sat, for example, we had international staff. I subsequently met every single one. I, had dinner or lunch or coffee with every single member of my international staff as well. So I think that those things I did well, and I think the actual business changes that that were made went well as well. The areas where I think I could have done better are l laying out and communicating the plan and was in my that was in my head early out to people. I think I did that about 6 months in. I probably should have done that day one or week one in, saying like, "Here's where we're going." In month six, I laid out a plan that said, "Look, we got efficient. Then we improved the product, and now we're selling." That was always in my mind. I think I should have communicated that out to people day one, not month six.
So one of what I'm hearing you say is that you went in and you said, okay, there's my term, there's sort of a leadership, senior leadership team. You had lunch with them individually. You talk with them to sign, get them to know. So you get to know who they were. They got to know who you were. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. But not just the senior leadership team. I tried to meet, I don't know, the next level down
Okay.
personally as well, like sitting on a half hour, hour long Zoom call, learning about what who they were, what they did in the company, what type of people they were, trying to share what type of person I was, the good, the bad. And in those conversations, at least on my side, I tried to be honest about what I was really good at and what I was, terrible at, right? Because I think that part is important, that you understand like where I'm going to help you, and conversely where you need to help me because I suck at something, right? Like a very silly example is I think of relationships in 30-minute snapshots, not in terms of long arcs of history. So if you pissed me off 5 years ago or even a month ago, I don't remember it at all. I may be very mad in the moment, but like 30 minutes later, I've forgotten that Rick pissed me off, because that in my memories, my emotional half-life is very, very low for negative things at least. I remember happy things for a long time, but that's a weakness, right? Because a lot of people, they remember that you pissed them off a year ago, or you said something nasty, or you spilled wine on them at a party, right? I would remember that an
Okay.
hour later.
All right. So I didn't hear you, and I'm asking a question, making an observation. I didn't hear you say, okay, I'm gonna call one or two, three, four. I don't know. And since you were in the consulting business, I'm kind of surprised you didn't say this, but you didn't call a meeting in the conference room and say, let's I'm here to hear what you think are where we should be going today, where the company should be going, and what are our strengths and weaknesses. And our, you know, I didn't hear you say that you went in and basically had pulled. I'm using the term leadership team, but pull a leadership team together and say, I want to hear what your vision is for the company and what you think we can be doing here. You didn't do that part of it as sort of what you would have done if you'd come in as a consultant. Is that right?
Correct. And that was a conscious decision,
Okay.
at least for at least two reasons. First is, I think when you have a bunch of people, what is it? If you have a bunch of people giving their ideas, you kind of always end up at a mediocre idea, right? Because everyone kind of hedges their ideas a little bit because they don't want to look stupid or come up with some Wild West idea in front of all their peers. People are much more likely to tell you their crazy cool ideas in private than they are in front of like 20 people who will make fun of them or poke holes in their ideas. So that's number one. And number two, at least for this company in this situation, what needed to be done over the first 6 months was very, very obvious. I knew the answer here. The answer was very much like we needed to run more efficiently from a cost perspective. Number two, we needed to improve our product quality. And number three, we needed to have a decision-making framework for how decisions were made on a day-to-day and month-to-month and quarter-to-quarter basis. So I had the vision in my head, number one, I had the vision in my head. Number two, when you ask people in a group setting for their ideas, they hedge their ideas, or they give you their mediocre ideas, or great ideas get watered down. Consensus is a great way for mediocrity.
Okay. All right. So, talk. Am I kind of going through the process here of your walking in day one, week one, and then what happened? So, I'm assuming, and I'm just picking this out, so you can use a different example if you want. There is a marketing and sales organization. So you are saying, okay, we're going forward. Here's what you, marketing and sales, are going to do. And I'm hearing you say we want to collect the numbers and know what's really the hell is going on out there. You know, we're not going to make decisions unless it's based on re a really qu understanding quantitatively, you know, what the market is, what our competitors are doing, pricing, all that sort of stuff. How did you tell them what you wanted them to do? Did you say, here's a plan, go do it? Or did you say, here are my goals, I want you to come back with a plan of how to implement this? What was the process for your giving direction to the marketing sales or any of the
Yeah,
departments
it was much
organization?
more the former. Here's a plan. Here's what I would like you to go do.
Okay.
Tell me where it's wrong. So I always gave everyone an opportunity to say,
Okay.
like, where's this wrong, either in its assumptions or in its execution? Because again, I'm not the world's greatest salesperson, or the world's greatest engineer, or whatever. I know how to run a business and run it profitably and grow it and make good decisions, but I'm not a technical specialist in any area of almost any area of business. So my plan was, my style, but also my execution in this organization was a little bit directive and consciously so, saying
Okay.
like, here's the plan that I would like you to go do. Here's the metrics that we're going to measure along the way. And here's what success looks like. Tell me if you have a better way of achieving this success. And sorry, I always explain why those metrics matter for the organization. Like, for example, in a software company, net retention rate is probably the most important metric. It's how many of your customers are you keeping each year? And it turns out it's actually more important than how many new customers you're selling. And a lot of organizations actually focus so much on new sales rather than like keeping existing customers that they never grow.
Yeah. Okay. I know you have heard this many times, but I will just say that the perception is that when a private equity company takes over a company, private equity investor takes over a company, that what they're doing is they're sending in somebody, it may not be you, but somebody you who says, I'm just coming in here, I'm running this by the numbers, we're going to make this efficient, we're going to cut costs, we're going to blah, blah, blah. And then from the inside, the people say, this guy comes in here, he doesn't know anything except numbers. He doesn't really understand this business or technology or blah, blah, blah. All he cares about is, you know, increasing our EBITDA profitability, so it'll look good on the balance sheet or whatever. Now,
Yeah.
I am sure you ran into people who in their mind were thinking that, if not saying that. So how did you
Well,
deal with
there are
that?
people. There's Glassdoor reviews. People were thinking it, and some people wrote it on Glassdoor. I actually Glassdoor with the employee review site. I encourage them to be honest, like good or bad, right? So look, there is some truth. I am very much a by the numbers guy, and I'm okay with that. Kind of because I'll give an example. So for this organization, when I had there were times before I had joined when the organization didn't have enough cash to make payroll at times. So they would often ask senior leaders, "Hey, can you wait a couple of weeks and we'll pay you in a little bit," right? So that's something uncomfortable that the way the organization was running, because it wasn't running efficiently. You did something like sometimes you couldn't make payroll, and that's kind of really not a good way to run an organization. By comparison, like after the changes that I made, while they initially encountered a lot of or resistance or saying like, "Hey, this is a crazy private equity by the numbers guy," I think 6 months pe later, people were like, "Hey, we're making payroll on time. We're hiring people. We're not afraid of the company going bankrupt. Our customers are happier." So they were better for not just for for the owners and for the EBITDA, but also for them because they got paid on time. They were it, and this was happening 22 when I was CEO of this company, or when I had started. Later that year, a lot of technology companies were laying off people. We didn't lay off anyone. We in fact added headcount because we had profits and we had financial strength. So I think you're absolutely right that inside the company, when these sorts of changes happen, when folks like me come up, there's often fear, hesitation, or as you said, just like emotional resistance, because this guy doesn't know anything about us, our culture, and he's just running by the numbers. But I think what people realize is over time, if the company runs well, it's not just more money, it makes everyone's life easier because you're not worried about putting out fires and being stressed about like getting calls from angry customers at 10 p.m. You can go home at 5 o'clock at night because your company's running well, your customers are happy, and they're not going to call you when you're in the middle of dinner with kids. And that's a really good feeling to have when you know that you're not, working truly 24/7 just to keep the ship from sinking.
Okay. You are, since I know a little bit more about your background than the people listening to this, you are one of those people who has had one success after another in your life. You went to Dartmouth, you went to Harvard Business School, you're now the CEO of this company. It's one success after another. Was there any time in this whole process where you felt you failed at something?
Yeah, lots of things, right? Like both at the microscopic levels, the macroscopic level. At the macroscopic level, in a personal context, I've been dumped. In a professional context, I've been fired from jobs. In a micro concept, lots of decisions I've made in some of these senior roles were wrong. But the good news, at least about the microscopic decisions, is I try and only take bets that don't have consequences of failure. But I like to take what's called asymmetric bets. When I'm right, I can do a lot more of it and continue doing it, and that's successful. And when I'm wrong, whatever, it's a couple of hours of lost work, or a couple thousand dollars in lost money. But when I'm right, you just scale it up a lot. So I like that kind of experiment driven
No,
gambling.
I often failure is the most valuable moment in our life because it's an opportunity for us to learn about ourself and what we need to be doing in our lives that's different to even be better than whatever it is we are. I mean, do you have anything you want to add about what you've learned from this failure or these failures or any failures like this?
I think probably two things, one good and one bad, both about myself. On the good side, like I take failure quite well emotionally. As I said, I have a very short emotional half-life for negative things in life, right? So I get up, when I fall down and scrape my knee, I get up quite quickly. And that's a good thing. The more difficult thing is I think of execution very much as kind of let's just go get the job done. And I think that doesn't that's rubs some people the wrong way, right? Because I'm so focused on just, get, excuse my language, getting shit done, both for myself and for the organization, and driving the kind of the overall success, that I forget that everyone involved in that is still a human being, right? And I don't think as much about kind of the softer side of things because I'm so busy driving results, and the results are good for everyone. Like, and this, when I was CEO of this company, every single year I gave every single employee a raise. Every single year. And they typically hadn't historically had raises in this company unless you went and demanded your boss give you a raise. So there's lots of good things I did for the employees, but I forgot that that is not enough. You have to, manage the human side of things. And that's something kind of I struggle with constantly and want to do and want to get better at over time.
Well, that's really good. We have to wrap up here, but I'm going to ask you one more challenge question for you to answer. And I'm going back to, again, this first day you walked in as the CEO, or the first week. What were you afraid of? Were you afraid that you might fail? Were you afraid that people wouldn't like you? Were you say, screw this, I don't care what happens, I know what I want to do? I mean, what How are you emotionally experiencing that for yourself?
So I think you talked a lot about fear. I am reasonably fearless. I think of almost everything in life as an opportunity, and I always think about the upside. So I had no fear showing up. Maybe that's irrational. I'm not brave, but I'm probably irrational. I think much more about the positive things in life than the negative. So I was not worried about people liking me or not, because I think some people are going to like me, some people are going to hate me. I wasn't afraid of failure because I was like, look, the business has room for improvement, and I'm very, very confident about this, and not based on feeling, but again, based on numbers. There were almost no negative feelings. It was very much like, this is an amazing opportunity. I get to be CEO of a company. I'd been co-CEO a couple of times before, but this is my first time just truly being CEO. And it has a company that has a lot of potential. The founder has made it into a pretty good company. Now let me take it from pretty good to great. And I know how to do it. This is so exciting. So I was very much focused on, like, this is such a cool opportunity, both for me personally, but for this company and our customers and our employees.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you saying is there weren't any underlying anxiety or fears that were said that you were saying, okay, I might be a little bit afraid of this, anxious, hesitant, whatever. I mean, I'm making the word, those are
No,
my words, not
I have
yours.
no,
But I'm gonna go through and get this done because I'm confident. I mean, anyway, if I'm wrong in what I'm
I
saying,
assume
correct
you're
me.
hearing me right. I have almost, almost pathological absence of anxiety, meaning the medical term, if in the big five personality traits, is neuroticism. I have extremely low neuroticism. I just don't worry about worry about the world and a like things are going wrong. I'm always looking at the upside. So there was nothing to get over, because it was just like, hey, this is an amazing opportunity. Let's go crush it.
Well, Nick, this has been great, a great conversation. I want to thank you for sharing your experiences with us. I think it's really helpful for others to hear about what it looked like from your perspective as you stepped into the CEO role, the new guy taking over from a well-liked leader, and then having to do a major transformation of the company. I think it's, as people hearing your story will grow from it, take lessons from it, and be more successful themselves. How can the audience who's listening to this learn more about you, perhaps even be in contact with you?
Sure. So our company's name, or sorry, our company's website is eaglerockcfo.com. There's kind of three things. Number one, there's a calendar link. So if you want to talk to me, you can book time with me. My calendar link is literally on the website. Number two, both my business partner and my emails are on there. And number three, we offer free software for people to get a taste of what our AI CFO software does. So if you're a small business owner, you can't afford that $500,000 CFO, and you want to have a very smart CFO working for you, go check out our technology.
Okay, that's great. So I also want to thank our audience for taking the time to listen. I think there's been a lot of value out of this conversation, and and tune in for the next podcast also. If you in the audience have a compelling story to tell about difficult decisions you've made and are open to sharing them, want to come on my podcast as a guest, please do that. The way to do that is to go to rickwilliamsleadership.com and then go to the podcast section on my website. So again, that's rickwilliamsleadership.com. Remember that you create the future by the decisions you make today. Take the time to get major decisions right, and yes, have a little fun along the way. Until next time, be well. What an interesting and inspiring conversation. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. Thank you for listening. Let me know if you have a compelling story to tell about making tough choices for your organization or for yourself. Coming on my podcast is a way to share what you have learned with a wider audience. If someone you know would be a great guest, please make an introduction. I welcome leaders with a story to tell and important learning to share. You can contact me about the podcast at podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. That's podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. Please share the link to my podcast with your colleagues. They will thank you for getting them access to these valuable conversations. And finally, please give us a great rating on and subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Just search for Create the Future with Rick Williams. Thank you for listening to Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast. Conversations with leaders who make difficult decisions and build lasting legacies.